360.
Talk Unchained.
What exactly is Talk Unchained?
It's going to be a mix of business and economics, politics, education, a little bit of international affairs. Talk Unchained. What I try to do is I try to be very informative and a little bit provocative at the same time.
Talk Unchained with Marlon Aldridge.
It's going to be something that's going to blow your mind, man, because I like to dig real deep, that research piece, and then just shock and awe, man. That's my style, the shock and awe. Talk Unchained.
Talk Unchained with Marlon Aldridge every Monday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, live only on American Muslim 360 Blog Talk Radio, the number one Islamic radio station in America.
Good morning to our audience on American Muslim 360 on Blog Talk Radio, and welcome to Talk Unchained. I am your host, Marlon Aldridge. Today we discuss deconstructing the agendas, attitudes, values, and behaviors of black elected officials. Amos Wilson, in his book, The Blueprint for Black Power, a Moral, Political, and Economic Imperative for the 21st Century, opines that the most persistent complaints the community makes concerning its current leadership are that they have either been co-opted by the ruling white regime, are outdated in terms of values, goals, and techniques, are not truly and deeply committed to the welfare of the people, are self-centered, self-serving, egocentric, corrupt, out of touch with current and future realities, timid, and cannot recognize the needs of the people or articulate those needs in ways which move the people toward their satisfaction, are intellectually inept, effectively educating the masses and inspiring them to realize the enormous power which lies dormant within themselves. A people are empowered or disempowered by the guiding ideologies of the leaders to whom they pledge allegiance. He goes on to categorize the current ideological orientations of black leaders. We will discuss these orientations as well as misconceptions that blacks have in general, which disempower them. So generally today, we're going to be talking about power and ideology. We're also going to be talking about the power inherent in ethnicity and the fact that we have a common heritage, culture, which means that we have a common set of values, or we should have a common set of values, attitudes, and behaviors, which act to strengthen us, to keep us coherent, and allow us to prosper. So, of course, I want you to participate, as always, and the call-in number is 515-605-9891. Again, that's 515-605-9891. Press 1 to get in the queue. You have questions or comments, and please, no speakerphones. You're listening to the show on another medium, as this may present feedback in the podcast. So what are these orientations, these ideological orientations that Amos is talking about? The first one is the assimilationist slash moralist, and this is the predominant leadership orientations. And this leadership is mostly composed of civil rights organizations such as the NAACP, the National Urban League, and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And they see that their chief goal as the full integration of black people into every sphere of collective white social activity to the point of coming deracialized. I want to put a little bit more emphasis on that. Deracialized, because it's going to come to a point where this ideology actually disempowers us, and we'll get into that. The moralistic color coloring of this leadership establishment follows from its belief that separation by race is morally reprehensible, that ethnic exclusivity is morally unconscionable. More pertinent, however, is its belief that racism, especially in the form of white supremacy and all that it implies, represents a fundamentally moral problem. They believe that whites must be born again according to the doctrines intimated in the Gospels. Cornel West, by the way, calls this the politics of conversion. Excuse my voice here. Despite its fight for equal protection under the laws of this country, it has yet to eliminate the vast disparities that exist between blacks and whites in every category of social activity. Moreover, it has proven impotent in solving intragroup problems such as rampant teenage pregnancy, devastating drug trafficking and addictions, black-on-black criminality and violence, cultural vulgarity, incivility, etc. Their dilemma is their unwillingness to confront white power establishments and systems, hoping instead for a non-racial fantasy world. A non-racial fantasy world. And if you look back through history, there is no evidence of such a thing. Ethnocentricity is rampant throughout the world that we live in, and evidently that is for a purpose. The second class of leadership is neoconservative / bourgeoisie. We're really talking about our merchant class and black conservatives. Insignificant in number, organization, and capacity, aligns itself with white conservatives, thus rallies against white liberals and black nationalists in that they feel no need for government programs and enforcement mechanisms, although they have benefited from them, and no need for culturally responsive, racially based programs of upliftment. And it claims that civil rights legislations and court decisions since the 60s have leveled the playing field for blacks and insist that claiming victimhood is counterproductive. And I know some of you in my audience probably would fall into this category. The categories are not mutually exclusive, by the way. So some of these orients, you may cross lines into some of these different orientations. And claims that affirmative action programs, watch this, distort the true merits of accomplished blacks. Ironically, black conservatives feed themselves by attaching to the purse strings of white conservatives. Moreover, they put a black face on white power and have adopted an extreme white American mythological, individualistic, blaming the victim ideological orientation. Consequently, black conservatives are more likely to attribute lack of black progress to our own moral deficiencies. I have referred to this type of thinking as the false doctrine of individualism, and I've actually written on the subject. The false doctrine of individualism, which ignores the forces of social structures and social conformity, but most importantly reduces individual progress to one's inherent traits or to one's DNA, or I'm fitter than you mentality. The tenet of social Darwinism, that's why I picked that up from. And that's the trap that I see that many of us fall into when we want to talk about us as individuals and to the exclusion of the environment that we live in. And I'm talking about the social structures that our culture puts forth in order to support us as well as to have us conform to the group, as opposed to going off rampantly trying to achieve our own ends and goals. And one of the problems that you run into with this type of doctrine is that Europeans, I see that they hold true to this idea of reductionism, where they want to reduce social activities, regardless of type, to biology. And, of course, in the subject of biology, we have genetics and inheritance. So when we're talking about humans, human beings, and their corresponding social activities, regardless of what they may be, whether economics, politics, education, militarism, what have you, they're basically reducing those activities, i.e. those behaviors associated with the activities, the thoughts and everything else, reducing those to a biological determinism, which is also a predominant philosophy in Western civilization. The idea of determinism, everything is basically determined by what is incorporated in our DNA. And that is a problem. That is a problem that we fall into when we want to look at ourselves as individuals to the neglect of the environment, which helps to develop and sustain us. And I think about as a child, you know, you have, what, 18 years of life that you spend with your parent. If this idea of determinism, i.e. what is incorporated in our genes, was so predominant, why does it take us 18 years of development? And to be true, to become a fully adult, it really requires about 21 years. An 18-year-old's brain is not fully developed, according to science, and it takes about 21 years in order for full development of young adults. The dilemma of the black conservative is that while other ethnic groups make use of power via attributes of their culture, organizations, and resources, the black conservative seeks to deny his own collective ethnic power and chooses instead not to be judged by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character. Ninja, please. And, of course, we've all heard these sayings before. The last group is the cultural nationalist. And while the Universal Negro Improvement Association and the African Communities Leagues, under the leadership of Marcus Garvey, and the Nation of Islam, under the leadership of Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, and today Louis Farrakhan, have attempted to address economic deprivation of blacks at home and abroad, under what could be termed black economic nationalism, most black nationalists are what are termed black cultural nationalists, who have made considerable progress in reconstructing African history, culture, and traditions after its corruption by European writers. They believe black people must free themselves culturally before they free themselves politically and economically. Now, I have problems with that right away. They must free themselves culturally before they can free themselves politically and economically. Culture helps to support these other social activities, politics, and economics, but there's more involved to it than that. And if that were the case, because I'd say that the cultural nationalists have made great strides. Although many products and artifacts of black cultural nationalism have been embraced by many segments of the black community, regardless of orientation, in terms of books, cultural rituals like rites of passage, clothing, the orientation of black cultural nationalist leadership, like the black assimilationist and the black neoconservatives have been unable to change the plight of the masses of black people in the diaspora. Its dilemma is that it overreacts to white insults on the collective consciousness of blacks by trying to prove the worthiness of black history, culture, and accomplishments, and does not provide political rationales, theories, developmental plans, working organizations, and systems to enable black people to regain sovereignty and to enhance their well-being and standing in the world. Other critiques are the retreat to militancy of so-called revolutionaries. Measure their militancy by how much black awareness they have or how bad they can talk. Their lack of intellectual vision and lack a consensually clarified set of goals and orientations are other negatives ascribed to this group. And I'm wondering what you think about what I have said. If you were to classify yourself, what orientation would you fall up under? And I'm suggesting here today that regardless of orientation of either one of these mindsets, regardless of their level of organization, regardless of their predominance, that we have still been able to improve our plight here and abroad. I don't care where we go on this planet, we have not been able to use the positives inherent in our culture, inherent in our common ethnicity, to move us and propel us forward. Those things are supposed to sustain us and to allow us to problem solve so that we may solve our common problems. They're supposed to assure us prosperity for coming generations. We seem not to be able to get that together and thus put ourselves in a dilemma. There are some other common misconceptions as well that we have among black people in particular. And one of the things that I have attempted to do, at least with my nonprofit and with my community work, is I have a saying that I've created, and it goes that knowledge is power, but organization is intelligence. And, of course, when I use that word organization, I'm really talking about our organizations and our institutions. It is very important that they be highly organized, have competent leadership, and be able to embrace our intellectuals. We seem to rally against them many times, against our so-called intellectuals. And that puts us at a disadvantage. Many times we look at intellectuals as just people that have written or either read or written books and view them as detached from ordinary folks. But here's the problem with that. You can't be an intellectual without looking, at least from the social sciences sphere, without observance, interaction with common folks. So when you really listen to an intellectual, they're giving your opinions back to you. That's the problem. They are giving your opinions back to you in consolidated, concise form. And so we have to realize that. We want to embrace those that are trained to be observant, those that are trained to collect data, those that are, and more importantly for me, those that are trained to evaluate and synthesize that data to be able to pull out its most meaningful attributes, i.e. the concepts, the principles, the theorems, and the laws. We view those as relationships, at least one concept to another. So we need to pay attention to our academicians and our intellectuals. We need to be engaged with think tanks, especially from a public policy standpoint. We need to make sure that we're getting the best information possible. And, of course, we need to turn to our so-called experts to do that. Anybody that is competent in that is worthy to be listened to. A smart person will judge you on what you say. They will not judge you necessarily on what school you graduated from. The most intelligent people can judge your conversation. What is coming out of your mouth? If they're well read, they'll be able to categorize what type of orientation and thinking that you have, what type of belief system that you have. Just by listening to the words, if they're well read, they'll be able to develop, take the words that you say and develop a conceptual, what we refer to as a conceptual framework that, again, allows us to categorize your mode of thinking. They'll be able to look or listen to what you have said and pick from it relationships. These are the principles that I'm talking about. A principle is a relationship. A law is a relationship. So it's very important that we pay attention to our academicians and our intellectuals. Judge them by what they have said, not by who they are. That is fallacious argumentation when we want to try to disparage our intellectuals. We refer to those as ad hominem attacks. And you see a lot of this going on. And we also see that many people will try to use rhetoric. In other words, they're trying to convince you to choose a certain position, when in fact that position may be disadvantageous to you. It may not benefit your community. So our intellectuals, at least the best ones, are going to be able to analyze what has been said, what has been written, and to determine via evidence, right? I'm talking about the research database, the knowledge base, be able to go out and collect data, right, i.e. get out there among the people and actually see what it is that they are saying, and then also to see what it is that they are doing, because sometimes, many times, as a matter of fact, what people are saying is not actually what they're doing. So academic folks and intellectual folks are able to discern between the two, what the masses are saying and what they are doing. They're also able to do that among our organizations, regardless of what they are, whether they're educational organizations, political organizations, business entities, and so forth. We have to really be able to look at the world, observe it, and then, more importantly, to understand how it works. That is the common problem that I am seeing among our people, is that we go to work and we work with these power brokers every day. We have occupations among them, and so we see what they're doing, but we don't actually understand what they are doing or why they are doing it. And I say that, I'm using logic here, because if we understood it, we would be able to extract from that and develop our communities. And so by observation and by evidence, if we are still lagging behind in terms of the many disparities, some of which I've already mentioned, then we must not know how to fix those common problems that we have. I'm going to go to the line and see if we have a caller from 636. Caller from 636, if you'd like, state your name and where you're calling from.
Yes, Kareem Hamid, calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning to you, Marlon Aldridge, and good morning to everyone on the AM 360 line this morning. And I wish peace upon us all. When we speak of individual, I don't want this confused with just individual effort, but the value of the individual is important to the value of the group. The group is made of individuals, and any effort put forward is based upon the commitment of the individual in that effort and in that group. So we can have an organization with a progressive motto, and think that a motto will do what needs to be done. No, the group is only as strong as the individual commitment to that model or that set of principle or those efforts. So the individual cannot be ignored. When you strengthen the individual and the individuals come together in any effort and they are committed to that effort and individual commitment, then the effort, then the organization, the group, be it 3, 4, 5, whatever number, the success is based upon the individual commitment and educated to the process. So I think that is where we sometimes make a mistake at. The intellectual is needed. He has knowledge. He is trained. But at the same time, he cannot ignore that you need to strengthen, pass that knowledge on to every individual. When you educate the individual, you educate the group. The group is no more than a collection of individuals. See? So I'm not speaking of just going out individually on your own. That's fine. Yeah, I won't take anything from that. But the importance of the individual cannot be overlooked, because the group, the process, the organization is comprised of individuals, and what is needed is proper education and individual commitment to the effort. I'll stop right there, my brother. Excellent presentation you're making this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Kareem. And I was in your neck of the woods over the weekend visiting some people. I reached out to you but wasn't able to get in contact with you. Brother Kareem, some St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks for your call. I want to talk about one of the things I did talk about, culture, and I hope that people understand when we mention culture, culture protects and sustains people. What are we talking about? Embedded in a culture are common values, common attitudes, common behaviors. Of course, normally associated with that is language, And we're also talking about the various forms of social activities, politics, education, business. And, of course, there are. Family is part of that. One's religion or spiritual belief is part of one's culture. These are commonalities. And we should understand that because regardless of where we go, if we move to Iran or one of the countries in the Middle East, we'd probably have, well, there's no probably to it, we'll have a new set of attitudes, values, behaviors. We'll have a different form of religion or spirituality. We have different ways of doing business. And I don't care where we go on the planet, we'll see this. So culture is very important, not only to the collective, but to the individual, because the individual learns via its culture and is only as effective as what his culture offers to him or her. Okay, and then, so of course, social structure comes into play too. And I looked this up. I wanted to make sure I gave you to this correctly. Social structure is the pattern social arrangements in society that are both emergent from and determinant of the actions of individuals. You don't have culture without having groups of individuals. On the macro scale, social structure is the system of socioeconomic stratification. We're talking about class structure would be an example. Social institutions, like our ecumenical institutions, our educational institutions, or other pattern relations, check that word out now, is the most important part. Relationships between large social groups. The way I see it in the social sphere, when people are involved, large groups of people, we are talking about relationships. So when you talk about politics, they can give you that mumbo-jumbo definitions all they want. You're really talking about relationships. Talking about educational institutions and policies, what are you talking about? You're talking about relationships. When you're talking about church, mosque, temple, synagogue, whatever, you're talking about relationships. Okay, so don't get it confused when all of these academic words are bandied about. They're really talking about, they include you. That's important to understand that. On the mesoscale, it is the structure of social networks. So we're talking about networks or ties between, watch this, individuals or organizations. On the micro scale, it can be the way, it can be the way norms shape the behavior of individuals within the social system. So again, we're looking at these structures which are embedded in culture, okay? Culture would be the larger category under which social structure falls. And these are ways for us to shape individual behavior. And then, of course, those that go against the grain, we say that they deviate from the norms, the group norms, and we say that they have deviant behavior. And, of course, these people we try to ostracize in some type of way or criminalize these people. The social norms influence social structure through relations between the majority and the minority. So this is what we are having to deal with really everywhere on the planet, because we've had interrelations with Europeans, some of them positive, some of them negative, because those who align with the majority are considered normal, while those who align with the minority are considered, watch this, abnormal. Majority-minority relations create a hierarchical stratification within social structures that favors the majority in all aspects of society. So I take that back from what we have said about the current types of orientational and ideological leadership styles of the three groups that were mentioned earlier. On the one hand, on the one side, with the assimilationist moralists, they want full integration, has to become indistinguishable. Now, why would you want to take something that sustains you, your culture, your ethnicity, which sustains you, and basically deny it? We want to deny our own culture and to become indistinguishable from other ethnic groups within America. Now, let's be honest. There are many ethnic groups within America. I noticed with whites, now, they do the same thing. They don't want to distinguish the fact that there are different ethnic groups within white America. Of course, we know that, those of us in the know that not to be the case. And one ethnic group in particular that has been predominant over the last 2,500 years and has a significant influence on world politics and economics and other forms of social activities have been the Germans. And the truth be told is that Germans are the largest ethnic group within the United States. Let me say that again, and you can look this up. Germans are the largest ethnic group. German peoples are the largest ethnic group within the United States. Look that up. And if you look at how they have influenced religion, when you look at how they have influenced philosophy, when you look at how they have influenced economics, significant influences. Okay, you don't have, at least from the way I'm thinking about it, you've heard of Martin Luther King Jr., right? Well, what about Martin Luther? Martin Luther was a German theologian. Now, this was back in the 1500s. And he is one of the predominant thinkers when it comes to the Protestant faith. At least on the Christianity side, which you have two major categories, Catholicism and Protestantism. Okay? And then, of course, for those of us that are Baptists or Methodists and all of these other religions, they fall up under the form of Christianity that Martin Luther promoted. Okay, I'm going to say this one, and I'm going to leave this one alone. You know I like to be a little bit provocative. Have you ever heard of replacement theology? Replacement theology. Of course, we know in the Old Testament, the Jews were God's chosen people, right? The Jews were God's chosen people. But then when the new, under the old covenant, but now we have this new covenant in the NGL or the Gospels, right? And the secret was, supposedly according to Jesus Christ, was that in the new covenant, the Gentiles were included along with the Jews. So now the Gentiles become predominant in the New Testament. Well, Martin Luther was one of the major thinkers in that replacement theology. I'm going to leave that one alone and go somewhere else. Take a commercial break, or should I say, excuse me, let's take a station break, and we will come back and continue our discussion, deconstructing the agendas, attitudes, values, and behaviors of black elected officials here on Talk Unchained. Okay, it looks like I'm having some difficulties with the PSA, so we're going to stop that and continue our discussion, deconstructing the agendas, attitudes, values, and behaviors of black elected officials. Of course, I would like to get your questions and comments, the call-in number is 515-605-9891. Press 1 to get in the queue if you have questions or comments. I think this is a very important discussion, by the way. And one of the things we've mentioned, education already, and many of our children are not learning. Despite all of the public policies that has been promoted, besides all of the money and attention that has been put into education, our kids are still not learning what they need to learn in order to be competitive in this society, and more importantly, to be able to solve the problems which afflict the black community and society in general. And I thought one of the reasons for that is our ideological orientation. When we look at education, we should look at it from this standpoint, from a political standpoint. When I say politics, I'm really talking about power relationships, power differentials, power advantages, because that's really what politics is about. If you look it up in the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, it'd probably give you something about the governance of people, because the word politics has to do with, the root word has to do with people, right? And so the governance of people. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist. If you watch news like I do, they're talking about power. They're arguing among each other. They're trying to undo what the Democrats are trying to undo, what the Republicans have done, and the Republicans are definitely trying to undo what the Democrats have done. And so they will shame each other and participate in all kinds of body activities to try to get an advantage on one political party or another. So, yes, politics is about power. Politics is a social activity, and all social activities are about relationships. Understand that. So our students, if they were to just change their thinking about why they are studying a particular subject and put it in the context of how can I use this as a person to improve my plight? How can I use this particular subject to improve the plight of my family? And then, of course, lastly, how can I use this information to improve the plight of my community? There's another side of that. How can this information be used against me, against my family, and against my society? And I'll give you a quick example. For those of us who study psychology, we are familiar with B.F. Skinner. He's a behavioral psychologist. And basically, he was not concerned with the thoughts in people's minds because he could not observe what's inside of somebody's head. But what he could observe is those behaviors that were developed by virtue of putting stimuli in front of a person. In other words, controlling a person's environment. Of course, he dealt with mice or rats or whatever. And he could get the mice to change their behavior by either providing them with something external, i.e. maybe food. You participate. In other words, limiting their behavior in some type of way via, in the terminology we like to use, via carrots and sticks, positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. So we're able to allow people via carrots and sticks to participate in some behaviors while not participating in others. In other words, we can control their behavior by controlling their environment. And, of course, he dealt with mice. So a person studying that, well, may think, well, why am I concerned with mice? Well, let's make that political. Now the mice become people. Okay, okay, now we can see what's going on. Okay, so my behavior can be controlled by controlling the environment which I live in. It takes on a whole different meaning now, doesn't it? And that's the type of orientation or type of thinking that we need to inculcate in our kids. Let's make everything political, i.e., how am I empowered or disempowered by what I am learning? How can I take this material and use it to my advantage? Even in an English class, it's teaching you how to write. Well, that's important. If you want to go out and write a grant, if you want to go out and write a business plan, those are things that we need to support our organizations, right? And this is the type of thinking that we need to inculcate in our children. They need to make every subject or look at it and interact with it from a political standpoint. I need to develop my own personal power. I need to help provide for my family, and, of course, I need to solve the problems within my community. Let's look at some of the common misconceptions, and these are just my observations. And, of course, there's always a subject to change. If you consider yourself an intelligent person and you are stern in your belief, then you're really not that intelligent because I can tell you the science is subject to change when new information is brought forth that enlightens us. Common misconceptions among black people: thinking on average that they can make a difference in situations where they are the minority but the majority rules, i.e., in elected or appointed positions but outnumbered by whites. Let's say you're on a board, and let me back up. I'm not saying that you can't make a difference. I'm saying that it's going to be a whole lot harder for you to make a difference when consensus or really majority rules. In other words, there are 7 people on the board. It only takes 4 for a decision to be implemented. Okay, so you're on the board, there are 7 people, and you're the only one on the board. You have 1 vote against 6. Okay, so if those people are all of the same ethnicity, there are certain commonalities, there are certain problems, right, that they may have that they need to solve that may not relate to problems that your community needs to be solved. I'm going to give you a real example. I'm going to give you one personal example that I've had to deal with. Now, I have allergies, and during the change of seasons, my allergies really act up. So I'll go to the store, the pharmacy, and I like to use Claritin D. That seems to work when I have when my allergies are acting up. But now in Ohio, when you go to get Claritin, I guess it has something that is used to produce meth. There's something in it. So you have to show your ID, and you have to sign for that. Now, you can only get 30 pills per month. And I don't care where you go in the state, there's a database that maintains all of that. There have been times where I have needed more than 30 pills. I could have gotten some pills for my family, my children. And so now here I am in a situation where I can't get the only medication that I know of that will help me because of a problem that exists for the most part in the white communities. We don't have methamphetamine problems in the black communities. Okay, so I have to suffer because of that. Okay, so number two, looking for public entities to solve problems more commonly under the sphere of private enterprises. And my belief is that these type of people have a socialist mindset. Of course, in socialism, the government, there is no ownership. The collective owns the means of production. And, of course, there's a bureaucracy that runs all of this. And this is the type of mindset that black people have, at least many of them. They want the government to run everything. They want the government to create grocery stores. We have that problem going on right here in Dayton, where some of the major grocery stores are leaving the black side of town. And then, of course, black folks, we rally. We're political from that standpoint. When we stand to lose something, you can best believe that there's going to be some black folks, people that are going to rally, and for the most part are going to try to get these grocery store chains or these businesses to stay within their communities. Now, Aldi's is an example. Kroger's was one of the grocery stores that left, and then Aldi's was another. Now, Aldi's, their business model was for low income, but they've made so much money off of these low income people, they now want to change their business model and they want to attract higher income individuals. So they're moving out to the suburbs with more affluent, which are more affluent. In other words, they pimp the black community, and now they're going to take the profits from that and use those profits to appeal to a market with greater incomes. And they also conflate Marxist conflict theory, which I'm talking about the people with the socialist mindset, they also conflate Marxist conflict theory, which forms the basis of black revolutionary thought and black liberation struggle. Of course, this conflict theory basically suggests, it's talking about class struggle. You had the feudal system, of course, in Europe, and we know that consists of the monarch at the top, and then the aristocrats, the bourgeoisie class, and then the peasants and the serfs and the slaves on the bottom. And because of the conflict between those particular groups, it would ultimately lead to revolution. So black folks read up on that, and they like that particular aspect. Oh, I get to be a revolutionary. Also evident in the black liberation struggle, this is where this mindset comes from, the idea of revolution. But conflict theory is totally separate from socialism's purported economic benefits. They are a totally different thing. So here we want to be socialists, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that socialism does not compete alongside capitalism. And unless you can make the whole world socialist, you're going to be wasting your time. We look at what happens in Cuba, and they use that like to use that as a great example, their educational system, their health system, and things of this nature. Well, Cuba almost starved to death. Cubans almost starved to death when the former Soviet Union decided that they were going to change their political economic system. They're going to start to liberalize and start to take some of those state-owned enterprises, and really what they did, because they were corrupt. We see even socialist systems are corrupt. What did they do? These bureaucrats, these oligarchs, or these bureaucrats, what did they do? They sold these then publicly owned enterprises to their friends. And now you have all of these billionaires running around in Russia today, and the people are gaining very little benefit. So we don't look at all of the positives and all of the negatives when we think about these particular types of social systems, these economic systems, these political systems. Another misconception is thinking that leadership is secondary to unity, even when the evidence suggests otherwise. I've always said that good leadership produces unity. I'm going to say that again. Good, able leadership produces unity. Okay, so unity is a proxy for leadership. Look at the Black Lives Movement. There are leaders behind that. Okay, and the evidence always, all we have to do is look out at the evidence. When you look at these particular movements, go look up the leadership and see who's supporting these people. They're able to bring in financial support, whereas there's other types of leadership that can't bring in that financial support. And the Black National Groups is one of the examples I intimated earlier, very unorganized, unable to gain the financial support, and unable to compete with the assimilationist moralists. Thinking that elected offices are about speaking up, and this is the one that really kills me, thinking that elected offices are about speaking up and providing customer service to constituents to the exclusion of executing detailed strategic plans and objectives which benefit their constituents. So we go out and we register to vote and all of this. Got black candidates in the pipeline for elected positions. And we put them in and nothing happens. We put them in office and nothing happens. It's because they don't have any detailed strategic plans. They're not interacting with the think tanks. And they bow to the goals and objectives of the political party to which they are affiliated. And, of course, those goals are for goals and objectives benefit the majority, who are bound together by ethnocentrism, their culture, their attitudes and beliefs about their greatness over others, their superiority over others, thinking that maximizing the black vote will help them even when they have not made any demands of their candidates. Well, let's put them in office and hope for the best. So we act, then wonder, rather than plan and act. We act, then wonder as what the hell just happened, instead of planning and acting. And that's the problem. Let's talk about the Congressional Black Caucus, and we're near the end here. The Congressional Black Caucus was established in 1971 by 13 members, U.S. Representatives Charles Diggs Jr., Augustus Hawkins, Charles Rangel, Shirley Chisholm, William Lacey Clay, Lewis Stokes, George Collins, John Conyers, Ronald Dellums, Ralph Metcalf, Aaron Mitchell, Robert N.C. Nix, and Reverend Walter Fauntroy, District of Columbia Delegate to Congress. The CBC's membership includes an historic 49 members, 47 in the United States House of Representatives, including one Republican, that's Tim Scott, in North Carolina, or is either North or South Carolina, and two in the United States Senate. I know Cory Booker is one. I can't remember the other. And CBC districts are as diverse as the populations they serve. Okay, let's pay attention to that. CBC districts are diverse as the populations they serve. Some districts are rural, while others are urban. Some members represent majority-minority districts, while others do not. The remaining 25% live in small metropolitan areas and rural communities. Collectively, the CBC represents 78 million Americans, who are 24% of the total U.S. population, and 17 million African Americans, 41% of the total U.S. African-American population. Those 49 only represent 17 million African-Americans, okay? So that means that they represent more non-African-Americans than they do African-Americans. But yet, here we are looking for agendas for black people only. Now, that, why do you think these majority-minority districts, i.e. white folks, districts that have more white folks, why would they vote for a black person and not want that black person to represent their interests? That doesn't make any sense. But yet we have calls from people today, they're not doing anything for black folks. Well, that's because we've set ourselves up in positions where we have to represent the interests of white folks. And that's one prime example right there. Not to mention the fact that even with these 49 members, they are still a minority in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. So how much change can they really make? Okay. And let me finish up here. In this capacity, the CBC represents almost a fourth of the House Democratic Caucus. It goes to show you their philosophical philosophical orientation is that of the Democrats, which is left of the political spectrum. Of course, on that far end, we have socialism. So we're looking for government programs. And I went to their website, and man, they put forth a lot of legislation. Most of it never makes it out of committee because they're the minority. I see a lot of legislation in there for women, a lot of legislation for the LGBT community. And I can tell you right now, that community was singularly focused on LGBT. They weren't caring about the needs of black folks, the needs of Asian folks. They were caring about the needs of the LGBT community. And we've seen, at least during the Obama years, that they were able to gain political power and use that political power to have policies put in place which benefited them. Of course, now they're able to get married and enjoy the so-called benefits of being married, and also have to deal with the negatives of being married as well. But because they were singularly focused on their own needs, they were able to gain political power and thus gain political benefits. Whereas with us, we're all over the place. And you know, if you take coffee, dark black coffee, and you dilute it with milk, what happens? It's not black anymore. And so we dilute our power by trying to encompass so many different things. And as a general rule, I would say this is a problem with the Democratic Party. And that's why they're being outmaneuvered by this minority. Republican Party is a diminishing party. We don't understand. Many of us don't understand that. And here we have a situation even now where the minority has basically been over to take over both the Senate, the House, and the executive branch, and more so is taking over the legislative branch as well. So we're going to have to contend with that. I want to thank you for participating in our conversation today. Thanks to our audience for your thankful questions and comments. If you would like to listen to past episodes of Talk Unchained, visit blogtalkradio.com/AmericanMuslim360 and search for Talk Unchained or Marlon Aldridge among the on-demand episodes or in the search box near the top of the webpage. Tune in to more informative, thought-provoking broadcasts on AM 360 this evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Maya Alakali High, Uncommon Conversation, and Interfaith Engagement. This is Marlon Aldridge, and welcome back next Monday for our discussion, Investing in and Trading with African Nations. Same place, same time, same intellectual stimulation. Spread the word about the show and follow me on Facebook. Until next time, peace be unto you. As-salamu alaykum.